it is gone! A two-run home run for Rhys Hoskins into the second deck for Bryce Harper. Wait a miss, he got him! And Aaron Nola leads two. Segura on the run, reaches up and makes the grab!
Swing and a miss, struck him out!
Now batting for the Phillies, John Stolness.
Hey there, podcast pals, and welcome back to another edition of Hittin' Season. This is episode number 342. I'm John Stolness from The Good Fight. You can follow me on Twitter, at John Stolness. Coming up, lots to get to. We got the winter meetings are getting started this week out in San Diego, and none of us are really quite sure how active the Phillies will be, because you hear from one side, one person, that the Phillies are up against the luxury tax and are not going over, and then you hear from a couple other folks that we're going to spend crazy money again. So we'll try and figure out if we can see what's going on with the Phillies and what they might do this week. We will do our last week we did a snake draft of the Phillies hitters, offensive players of the decade, and tonight we're going to do a snake draft of Phillies pitchers of the past decade, and we got some Hall of Fame stuff to get into as well as a couple other nuggets. Joining me, as they do every Sunday night, is Justin Clue and Liz Rocher. Liz, of course, you know from Yahoo Sports. You can follow her on Twitter at Liz Rocher. Hello, Liz. How was your weekend?
Hello, John. My weekend was fine. I spent it doing lots of holiday baking.
Love the holiday baking. That's nice. Good stuff on the holiday baking. And Justin Clue, I'm sure, was also doing some holiday baking. You can, in between articles for Baseball Prospectus and Fangraphs, you can follow Justin on Twitter at Justin_Clue. Justin, did you make me any ginger snaps?
I'm making ginger snaps for, well, actually, I don't want to say because they might be listening and it's part of a Christmas present. But No, I did not make you any ginger snaps. So I have succeeded in both definitely outing whose gift that is and also telling you that I do not have a present for you.
I get devastated and someone else has a present almost spoiled. So I've done my job here tonight, everybody. So let's get to this here. We got the winter meetings coming up, and none of us really know exactly what the Phillies are going to be doing from here on out, because as you may have heard, the Phillies signed Zach Wheeler last week. We talked a lot about it on this podcast, and Justin and Liz talked about it on Continued Success, and so we've covered the Zach Wheeler ground pretty thoroughly here. But Matt Gelb from The Athletic reported last week, and Liz and I talked about this on Wednesday night, that the Phillies were told by management not to go above the luxury tax. And so we thought in the middle of the week that the Phillies would be pursuing the rest of the winter, looking for small moves around the edges to try and stay under that $208 million. Well, then Bob Nightingale comes along on Friday afternoon and puts out a tweet and a piece in the USA Today that says, "The Phillies, luxury tax be damned, are going all in and plan to pursue free agent third baseman Anthony Rendon." And then a few minutes after that, John Heyman follows up with a tweet, "Phillies have shown interest in Strasburg and Cole and seem especially interested in Stras. Possible that interest lessens with the Wheeler signing, but Philly seems to be going big again, just low-keying it this time. No stupid money talk. Bob Nightingale links them to Rendon, too." So we kind of have two conflicting things here, Justin. We have Matt Gelb of The Athletic, who, according to his piece, talked to two sources within the organization. And then you have Bob Nightingale and John Heyman talking to whoever they're talking to, saying something completely different. What is your take on these two conflicting messages, and which one do you think is right?
Conflicting reports. The klaxon blare of the winter meeting.
The hot stove is heated up.
What fun. Not to get too personal here, but I think it needs to be said that in the most general sense, I would trust a plugged-in beat writer's word over that of national writers. In this case, specifically because, you know, Matt Gelb has been writing about the Phillies for a very long time, and because Bob Nightingale has his reputation as a very nice person who is often wrong.
Just say he's wrong most of the time. You don't have to couch it like that.
And John Heyman has his reputation as a second mouth on the head of Scott Boras.
Oh, that's so where you have the mouth located, do you?
Take that for what it's worth. That being said, I mean, they didn't say these things for no reason. That reason may have been because Scott Boras wanted leverage over somebody. That reason might have been because Bob Nightingale legitimately heard from two people that that was the case, except those people aren't probably as, you know, high up in the Phillies organization as you'd want somebody to be giving you that kind of information. I don't know. We don't know. The point is their reputations are what they are, and I think you could use that to determine what is true and what is not here. However, these are two polar opposite things. Like that kind of, it's not like they're just like, oh, well, the amount of money is different or the amount of years isn't matching up. It's two completely different things, which is what's making this so entertaining and fascinating to me. So I'm very interested in how this goes. And I really like that the idea of the complete opposite of trying to stay under the luxury tax threshold exists, that it's even like a morsel of a concept. I would love to just have some form of entertaining chaos breakout, but you know, it's tough not to believe what Gelbrot is. It's tough not to believe that it's true. It's tough not to believe it's not true. Mm-hmm. It's easy to believe it's true.
Yeah.
There we go.
Yeah.
Yes. It's much easier to believe that that is true. You know, I want to imagine a world where they're just like, screw it, and start going after Rendon and going after Strasburg. That's what I'm rooting for. I would love that.
No, I know we're all rooting for that. Liz, I know you're rooting for that. I mean, this is one of the things that you had an issue with when we spoke on Wednesday night, was going after Wheeler kind of feels like a move where you're not really going after the fish that you need if you really want to put yourself over the top. I was really struck, Liz, by Nightingale's language that he used in the USA Today piece. I mean, he says, the Phillies' luxury tax be damned, plan to strongly pursue free agent third baseman Anthony Rendon, with third baseman Josh Donaldson as a potential fallback plan, two people with direct knowledge told USA Today Sports. The Phillies, who got Wheeler on Wednesday, would go over the $208 million luxury tax for the first time with the potential signing, but it has not deterred owner John Middleton and the Phillies' aggressiveness in free agency. The Phillies handed Bryce Harper a big deal, blah, 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 blah. The Phillies still would like to pursue another starter and relief pitching, but Rendon has become their number one target. I mean, he's really laying it out there. He's not saying, like, you know, scuttlebutt is that the Phillies may consider going over the luxury tax if something happens. He's basically coming right out and saying, the Phillies say are going to go over the luxury tax, and they're going to try and go after one of these big fish. So does Nightingale's language make his position a little bit more persuasive?
In a perfect world, it would. I'd love to believe all of that. Currently, I'm obsessed with the idea that this is all just ridiculous gamesmanship from the Phillies. Like, it's like Klentak and Middleton working at opposite purposes now.
Yeah.
Like, in the weird soap opera, Klentak is talking to Gelb and saying, we can't go over the luxury tax. This is the word from above. Print this. And then on the other side, Middleton is furtively calling these two these two writers with a reputation and saying, we're totally going to spend all of this money. Print this. I just enjoy the thought of this being a soap opera. Like, that's definitely not happening at all. But wouldn't it be fun if it was?
It'd be fun if it was, yeah.
Do you think the Phillies' approach to this kind of thing has changed at all from last year when, you know, took forever to sign Bryce Harper, and the last offseason was what it was, and then this year, you know, it's different. And they've kind of changed, and the way they want to be perceived has changed, and we're supposed to believe John Middleton's taken a step back, and Matt Klentak is seriously running the show. I mean, do you think there's been a change in the approach to how they, like, you know, are using the media, if at all, to conduct their deals at these winter meetings?
I don't know. I mean, it sounds like, if what Liz is describing is what's going on,
it's not. No, let's be clear. Yeah, that was just, that's a play that I made up in my mind because it amuses me. That is not what's happening.
In Liz's version, there's long lost twins with eye patches. Yeah. There's people with amnesia. Yeah. There's ringing.
There's
phones.
Theme music, yeah, and people a rotating down, cast of actors.
People falling down open elevator shafts.
Right. Yeah, there's a gunshot followed by someone going, "Oh my god!"
Yeah.
And then, like, you don't know what happened next for months.
Dr. Drake Ramore is
Dr.
the physician
Drake,
on call.
Exactly. The empty elevator shaft is what gave that one away. Absolutely. No, I think, to answer your question, I don't know that they're approaching it any differently. I mean, last year we all knew that they were going to that they had to go out and get Bryce Harper or Manny Machado. I don't think anybody went into this offseason thinking they had to get Gerrit Cole or Steven Strasburg or Anthony Rendon. We all wanted them to, but I think that I wonder if John Middleton's was listening, and we know John Middleton listens to the fan base, listening to some of the feedback that they were getting about not going over the luxury tax. Maybe they floated that luxury tax thing out there to Matt Gelb to gauge public reaction. You know, that I don't know that that's what's going on, but it could be. And, you know, when you do that, you had to know what the response was going to be. The fans are going to want you to spend the money, especially because, as I reiterated in a post I did for The Good Fight, you have to pay a 20% tax on the overage. If you stay under $20 million over the tax. So let's say they spend an extra $15 million over the tax, okay? And so that's going to cost them an extra $3 million.
Yeah, it's nothing, really.
It's nothing. It's nothing. I mean, if you go over $40 million, it starts to cost you a little bit more, but it's not world-beating, and it only really starts to hurt you if you do it 2 years in a row, 3 years in a row, 4 years in a row, and it's still just money, you know, and you move down in the draft a little bit if you go over the luxury tax. You move down like 10 spots if you do it a certain number of years and a certain amount over. But, you know, I think the Phillies have gotten some serious blowback to the idea that they would go get Zach Wheeler and then pretty much call it an off season. So maybe they're also just doing it to kind of keep us all engaged in the off season. I don't know. It's impossible to see really what they're thinking right now.
I think the Phillies are, because the one part of all of, at least, you know, the Heyman and Nightingale reports that are true is that the Phillies are being aggressive. They signed Zach Wheeler.
Yeah.
He's making over $100 million. You know, the Braves have made a number of moves. The Phillies have made moves, or have made a move. And I think the White Sox have made a move. And that's kind of it. Like, that's more than what happened last year as far as stuff that would, you know, really make waves, make the front page of a baseball site.
Don't forget my Marlins.
Oh.
Your Marlins have made a couple of moves, too. Yeah. They've been big,
my Marlins. Big, yeah. Am I gonna get that on the back of a shirt for you?
I would prefer not to have that shirt.
You never know. Big occasions coming up next year, Justin.
This is interesting, though. I mean, it's a dichotomy of thought between, you know, these different reporters, and I tend to more believe the Matt Gelb side, because we know that Nightingale and Heyman are mouthpieces for Boris sometimes. I mean, we know that Boris goes to them with information, but Nightingale's quoting two sources, so who knows, you know, one of them might be from Boris's camp, one of them might be someone else.
One of them
else.
Might be his assistant.
It could be, you never know. I mean, I did a piece after the Bryce Harper thing last year where I just went through the whole history of social media from the beginning of the offseason to the end of the offseason about the Bryce Harper pursuit. And every team was close to getting Bryce Harper, or was, you know, it was ridiculous how this all goes down. And we have to remember what the offseason is like. It's a lot of noise. But I agree. You know, what's really cool is that it does seem like the offseason is gearing up faster than the last couple. It seems like we've got more teams that want to be aggressive here in the early going of this, and that's one of the reasons I think the Phillies got Zach Wheeler so early, is I think there were other teams that were ready to pounce and ready to pounce quickly, and the Phillies decided that they had to be ready to pounce early too. So, you know, who knows? I mean, maybe they didn't plan on going for Zach Wheeler this early. Maybe they wanted to let the market shake out and they wanted to kind of see what else was out there. But everybody seems to be more motivated this offseason, which is nice. Maybe that collective bargaining agreement, potential strike or lockout coming, you know, when the CBA is over, is spurring some teams to action. The Cincinnati Reds are really aggressive early on. You know, the Padres are making a lot of noise. A lot of these teams that have been kind of lying in the weeds the last couple of years, some of these mid-market teams are serious this time around.
I'm just curious. Yeah, I think that's a pretty honest assessment. But yeah, I mean, just knowing that this team has been much more concerned about its public image in matters like this, I just popped in. I was just curious, given how last year was approached and how much we've learned since then. And yeah, I do think the lower profile-ish nature of this year, where they're not just one of the teams chasing down one of these huge, huge whales, is definitely going to change things. We were saying, John, you said they don't, you know, they needed to get Bryce Harper last year, but this year they don't need to get one of these high profile pitchers, but they do need to get better pitching. So,
sure.
I mean,
and they
are
did.
You thinking, yeah, and they did, they improved. So are you thinking like that's, that's kind of what that's been addressed.
I think in their minds they've probably addressed it, and I think if they get another pitcher, that it's probably someone a little bit in the lower tier, like a Teheran, you know, like a Ryu, you know, something like that, like a Wade Miley, or, I mean, a couple guys have already gone off the board. So, I mean, I don't know how long they can sit around and wait for another starting pitcher, but I think maybe they're thinking, you know, we get Wheeler and then we get the big money third baseman, you know, or I still think Didi Gregorius is the guy that they're really eyeing, you know? And so that's the other thing, is I think Didi Gregorius makes more sense for who their manager is, who their bench coach is. I think they, you know, I don't know. I mean, it'd be great to be able to take him away from the Nationals and swing him to the Phillies and just settle third base. And it's easier that way. If you're not going to worry about the luxury tax, just going out and getting your third base position filled makes so much more senseless than
they haven't
than
had a third baseman in
forever.
Name a year
since Scott Rolen left. Like, Polanco. But, you know, was Polanco really?
He wasn't there for them.
He was an infielder who they put at third base.
Yeah. That's just how
and
it
he
was.
Wasn't that good offensively his second time around through here. He was okay for a half a season. And what was it? 2010 was his first year. And then
all Polanco does is hit was something that was on Twitter at the time.
Yeah, that's not true.
That and his giant, enormous pumpkin head. He has a huge melon of a head.
One of the things that I read in The Athletic, a piece by Mark Carrig and Andy McCullough, was they did a piece about the pressure index, or the ranking every Major League Baseball teams need to win the winter meetings, whatever the hell that means. And that's what I wanted to ask you. They have the Phillies at number 2. So only one other team in baseball has more pressure on them to win the winter meetings than the Phillies, which, again, I think this assumes that the Phillies are going to go over the luxury tax, because there's no way the Phillies can win the winter meetings and still stay under the luxury tax at this point. The only other team that they say is under more pressure is the Angels, and I agree that the Angels have to do something at this offseason. It doesn't have to be at the winter meetings, but they have to supplement that roster with a Garrett Cole or Steven Strasburg or Anthony Rendon. They got to get something. But the Phillies at number 2 seemed really high to me, given what they did last offseason, given that they got Zach Wheeler. And given that
you sound like the Phillies.
Yeah, well, I mean, just like, I don't know what else. I'm not convinced they're going over the tax, is what I'm saying. You know?
Mm-hmm. You want to know a secret? That whole thing that you're talking about is entirely made up.
Oh, yeah.
It doesn't mean anything.
It doesn't.
You know who won the winter meetings last season? No one. Because no one made a deal. You know who won the offseason? The Phillies. Because they made a bunch of deals outside of the winter meetings. The winter meetings are what every team makes of them. And so the need to win is driven by what other teams are doing. Because if no one's going to make a deal like last year, then no one wins. It's made up. You don't win the winter meetings. You win games during the season. And that leads you to the World Series. The moves you make in the offseason are part of that. But, I mean, the reason why these teams need to win the winter meetings is because they need to make moves that win them more games. Like, the idea of winning the winter meetings is so stupid.
It is dumb.
It's so stupid.
But doesn't that just mean, like, which of these teams makes during this, you know, specific time period when a lot of deals do happen, the team that makes the most deals that make sense to them, addresses their needs and acquires them, like, talent in their positions where they need it, that's a team that's who wins the winter meetings.
Yeah.
And that team is now more set up to win more games. But then again, I can't really think of the last team that, quote unquote, won the winter meetings or won the offseason and then went on to win the World Series.
2009,
as well.
The Yankees. Like, that was like the only time I could think. You know what
one.
I mean? But no, but seriously,
but there
you're
aren't
right.
A lot of deals done at the winter meetings anymore. This is like everyone remembers a time when there were some, but the past 2 to 3 years, there's been nothing really.
Yeah.
There's been nothing. And so this is an abstract concept, because maybe a team this year, because the market does seem to be moving faster. At least 3 teams have caused it to move faster. God knows what the rest of them are doing. But, you know, there's this momentum forward. Maybe it will change. Maybe some team will leave the winter meetings actually doing what you said, Justin, like being completely set up, you know, or being, closer to being set up. But I think what we're mostly going to see are just teams making one move or, you know, 2 moves. Like, how do you win the winter meetings when you sign 2 minor leaguers?
Yeah, no, that's true. Although I will tell you, Jeff Passan has been reporting, and I saw Ken Rosenthal reporting tonight that the Garrett Cole market is moving pretty quickly.
And
most
that
people
would be
seem
something.
To think he's going to get signed at the winter meetings.
I like it. Let's do it.
Yeah. So that
the Yankees can win the winter meetings.
Yeah, there you go. And then Strasburg all of a sudden is probably going to get more money than he would have gotten because now you've got teams panicking who didn't get Garrett Cole going after Steven Strasburg. It just feels like, you know, there's a lot more teams involved early here with some of these guys, and the winter meetings might actually turn out to be something. So last thing before we get to our break, and this is about the winter meetings too, Matt Klentak at the winter meetings. What is your confidence level, Justin, with Matt Klentak as this team's general manager, given what he did last offseason, given the Zach Wheeler signing? You know, I don't know that any of us feels great about Matt Klentak. What is your confidence level of Klentak as this team's GM going to what was now his fifth winter meetings, I think?
What is my gauge? Am I my confidence? Is it 1 to 10? Is it
let's go 1 to 10.
To 5?
Yeah, 1 okay. to 10.
My confidence level that he will win the winter meetings, just make
the team
a deal
significantly
that,
better.
Okay, make a deal that I like.
Or won't hurt the team.
I will see. He actively does not hurt the
Such
team.
Such a low yeah, bar, a really.
Yeah.
My confidence in that is probably.
Never meeting the road.
I don't want to. Every answer feels like a coward's way out. I honestly, 5 is the first number that comes to my head because it's like, yeah, I'm not. I want to give him more credit. I want to be like, look, it's different. It's a different set of rules we're playing with. It's but he's the same GM, and the plan is still the same. You know, the front office is still the same. Gabe Kapler leaving didn't really change the philosophies in place in the Phillies organization right now and the plans they seem to have. And we spent the past week or so talking about how this team seems to still think it can acquire not the best talent, but make it the best talent or use it to be the best talent. And we've yet to see that really pan out for them, but they still believe they can do it. And maybe they can. That's totally, totally plausible that we've just not reached the beginning of the era where the Phillies make those moves and see them pay off. So I don't know. I've sort of started to envision baseball and then like making the right deals as kind of more of a wheel of fortune. And it's kind of like the Phillies are due to have some of their deals like this pay off, where somebody's knee doesn't explode the first day of the season, or somebody actually performs up to the talent level they were acquired to perform at, Jake Arrieta. But I think there's enough moves the Phillies could make that Matt Klentak actually makes a move that people like at these winter meetings. So I'm going to bump it up to a 6.5.
Okay. Liz, how
seven,
about...
7 felt high.
7 does feel a little bit on the warm side.
I was
yes,
going to try and be like, no, I feel 7. And then I thought about it and I couldn't do it because that's too high. 7 is too high. I'll stick with 5. I think you're right. There are probably a bunch of moves that he could make. He's already made one move, but I don't also want to take 6 because you took 6.5. So I'm just going to stick with 5.
I like the aggressiveness of the Wheeler move. I haven't really talked about that.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been jealous of the Braves and how much they seem to know who they want and then get that player. And, you know, I don't expect the Phillies to really adopt that mentality across the board, but it's cool that they already have addressed their biggest need before the winter meetings have even started. And they did it by acquiring, you know, not some, you know, I keep saying, oh, they want to acquire not the best talent. I mean, of the talent available, he is actually, Zach Wheeler, some of the best pitching talent available, certainly on the free agent market. So I do like the aggressiveness in getting him, and I'm hoping that that is something that continues as we move forward into this patch of days when a lot of deals typically, except for the past few years, take place.
Well, doubling back on what we started on here with Matt Gelb versus, not, and they're not matching up with each other, but Matt Gelb versus Bob.
King
Don't
Man.
Fight it. Don't fight it. Come on.
I would just say Matt Gelb has tagged in Jim Salisbury, who has a piece out that just hit a few minutes ago as we were talking about
Ooh,
all this.
Let's see it.
Intrigue. Yes. He says, the Phils are still monitoring the markets for free agent third baseman Josh Donaldson and Anthony Rendon, but don't get too excited because they appear to be more interested bystanders than active pursuers. Signing a shortstop like Didi Gregorius, who just so happens to be a favorite of Girardi, would keep third base in play for the eventual arrival of Alec Boehm, who will start the 2020 season in AAA. Some rival evaluators do not believe Boehm can survive there, blah, 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 blah. There is competition for Gregorius. If the Phillies don't sign him, they look at Starlin Castro, Todd Frazier, or Brock Holt as short-term fits at third base or other infield Ooh. Spots. And then he talks about,
brutal.
That's bad to me.
That was bad.
Give me Eric Sogard over any of those guys as a short-term solution. But he's also talking about the pitchers. He says the Phillies are speeding toward the $208 million luxury tax threshold. And Wheeler, by all indications, will be their top wintertime expenditure. Says the Phillies are about $19 million under the tax, and that's before adding an infielder, bullpen help, and some rotation depth. He says the Phillies are looking at, if they get more rotation depth, from the third and fourth tiers of the market. So you've now got Gelb and Salisbury basically kind of singing the same tune, that the Phillies are going to try and stay under the luxury tax. Certainly a different tone entirely from Bob Nightingale.
It is tough not to believe now, just as it wasn't very tough not to believe it earlier, but now even more so, that this is not exactly what's happening.
Yeah.
Like, now it seems like, you know, national guys like Heyman and Nightingale seem even further away from the orbit of actual Phillies information. So, yeah, I mean, I got to tell you, it doesn't make me feel, kind of want to bump it down to a 4.
Yeah, I'm not unhappy with my 5 now.
Given this new information.
Yeah, I'll go 4. I'll go 4. But, I mean, Klentak can only do so much if he's told not to go over the luxury tax. So
let's not pretend that he wants to.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he'll get points for being smart and clever and frugal.
The special Love secret that. GM's World
yeah,
Series
GM
that
trophy.
No one knows
yeah, the
about.
GM belt. Yeah, pretty good stuff there. I'm sure it's got lots of jewels on it. Imagine him wearing a big fancy belt with jewels around it.
No.
Just like,
no, I cannot.
No, I can't either. It'd be fun, though. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll get into some Hall of Fame stuff real quick as soon as we take a quick time out. So that'll be up next here on Hittin' Season. And we're back on Hittin' Season. The Hall of Fame Veterans Committee, who last year inducted Harold Baines into the Hall of Fame, much to the astonishment and chagrin to some in the Hall of Fame community.
Woof.
I know Justin loved it. It was it was truly a kind of a spit in the eye of a lot of the traditional small hall guys. But this modern baseball era ballot that they do, I don't know how they get away with it, frankly, because you have the normal voting committee. Once you've fallen off the ballot, I don't understand why people get a second chance to get on there. I mean, it's a good way to right some wrongs, I guess. But anyway, there are a number of players.
I'm sorry to clarify. Those committees are made up of executives and players who don't get to vote on the Hall of
Fame.
And so this is, the players, for better or for worse, getting a voice.
Right. So. It's a 16-person committee. It's called the Modern Era Committee's Hall of Fame. And there were a number of players who were up for consideration this year. And two got in. Two different people. One player and Marvin Miller, who was a long time. What's that?
He's an executive. Baseball.
Yeah, a longtime executive who kind of was one of the integral reasons why free agency became the way it was in Major League Baseball. So the players, he should have been in a long time ago. To be fair, he had a huge impact on the game of baseball. So Marvin Miller was inducted. He got 12 votes. You needed 12. 12 of the 16 members of this committee needed to vote for a person to be inducted. And catcher Ted Simmons got 13 votes, and he was elected into the Hall of Fame. Most people seem to be receiving that one very well. Ted Simmons, one of the great catchers in baseball history. I think he made 8 All-Star teams during his career.
Oh, my God.
Yeah,
he was a really good player.
Third most games caught.
Yeah. Really, really good player. So some other guys who were on the ballot and just missed: Dwight Evans got 8 votes. Dave Parker got 7 votes. Steve Garvey and Lou Whitaker got 6 votes.
I can't believe those two got the same number of votes.
It's not even
Lou
close
Whitaker,
how much better Lou Whitaker is than Steve Garvey.
It's a freaking travesty. Sweet Lou Whitaker, it's really gross. And that Steve Garvey got the same number of votes is just disrespectful.
And Don Mattingly and Dale Murphy were on fewer than 3 ballots each. I mean, growing up as a watcher of 80s baseball, Don Mattingly and Dale Murphy were two of the biggest stars of the 80s. And I'm not a small hall guy. I'm a large hall guy. And those guys were two of the very best at what they did for more than 10 years. I would have put either one of those guys in if I had a vote. But Justin, what did you make of the list here? Ted Simmons, Marvin Miller getting in, some of these other guys not getting in. And what do you make of the committee as a whole?
The Marvin Miller thing is one of the more fascinating ones, given that he not want to be in the Hall of Fame?
He didn't.
Wasn't that?
No, and he made his wishes very clear.
Very clear to his son.
I remember that. All the way, his grandson, I think, spoke to Emma Bocelleri of Sports Illustrated and said that even in, like, several days before he died, he asked him, as he had been asking him, and he was adamant. He did not want to be included, and he didn't want anyone, his relatives, to be included. He did not want to be nominated. He felt that slighted by them, that they had not elected him. So
I was going to say all that. So imagine that I said
I'm
that.
I'm so sorry.
So that my answer is even more substantive than what it's going to be. No, I'm kidding. but no, I found that an interesting development. I don't know if I've heard of too many guys getting voted in who said, like, nah, I didn't want that. And people just kind of forced them in anyway.
Yeah, museums are boring. You're going.
So that was interesting. As far as the committees go, yes. My interest in the Hall of Fame has been well documented. I find it very difficult to take seriously, and I think that is very sad because I would love to take it seriously. It's just, you know, this process has been trivialized and toxified over the years, and grown men have acted like children. It's been honestly been the process that's really pulled back the curtain on, like, realizing, oh, some of these baseball writers are, like, absolute children, and, like, people I used to respect. It's just, yeah, it's tough. So for that reason, I've made it not matter to me very much over the years. But these smaller committees, I really do appreciate them. If there was a window for me to climb back into having interest in the Hall of Fame, it would be through one of these or a couple of these, because they just seem much more human about it. You know, there's this odd sort of, like, sentinel authority that baseball writers believe they wield with their ballots, and, like, the disjointed and fractured sense of justice that kind of permeates their decision making. I mean, we had writers this year, like, grown ass men submitting ballots just with Derek Jeter's name checked off. Like, you're going to try to tell me that's not the exact same kind of fanboyism you're going to get from one of these committees that people bitch about all the time? Like, come on. That's ridiculous. That means you just had your Derek Jeter's poster on your ceiling every night when you went to bed. Like, relax. So, that being the case, I have an affinity, at least, for these smaller committees that are voting in guys who, like Ted Simmons, who everyone has always, like, appreciated and respected, and who, you know, it's not like they were bad baseball players, but probably didn't have a chance in any other capacity to get into the Hall of Fame. So I have an appreciation for that, definitely, and I have the utmost respect for somebody who doesn't want to be in the Hall of Fame, but is so undeniably Hall of Fame that they get in anyway.
Yeah, Liz, what did you make of the voting as it went down?
I mean, I think the question of whether or not to include him due to his wishes is really interesting, and whether or not it's possible to honor his legacy appropriately without him being in there. You know, whether that would be sort of collaborationist with the things that he fought against for much of his career, the establishment having control over the game as opposed to it being of the players, you know, or a collaborative thing. So I find it interesting because I feel like he should be, I feel like they need to put on his plaque. They need to, you know, Marvin Miller did not wish to be included in the Hall of Fame. I think that would be fair. I think that would be a tribute to his legacy and
conscientious observer to the Hall
I
of
think
fame,
it would
Marvin
tell
Miller.
Everyone everything they needed to know about him. I think it would inspire people who go to the Hall of Fame to learn more about him. I feel
Did
that
they say
it allows
why he
the
didn't want to be in the Hall of Fame?
Because they constantly overlooked him and devalued his work.
Okay. I didn't know if it was anything more than that. You know what I mean? But Okay, that makes sense. And I guess the question I have when I think about Marvin Miller getting in is, and I think I mentioned this before when talking about Scott Boras, the impact that he's had on the game, the amount of money that he's made for players, how he has changed the nature of agents and the relationship between agents and owners. And I'm curious what you guys, I don't remember if we talked about this last year or not, but I would put Scott Boras in the Hall of Fame. I think he's had a huge impact on the game of baseball. In some ways good, but also in some ways not so good. But he's made so many players a ton of money and helped to move the game, move salaries along in baseball. What are your thoughts on Scott Boras getting in?
I need to ask you a question first, John.
Sure.
Do you see the difference between what Scott Boras and what Marvin Miller did?
Oh yeah, 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 okay. Yeah. No, for sure.
Because what they do is much different, which is why, yes, I feel like, why I really have mixed feelings about including Scott Boras, who is not really an advocate for anyone but himself. He advocates for players and I believe is mostly a net force of good, but I believe that he fights for only the best players, the players that hire him, and they give him a huge chunk of their earnings, so he is incentivized to do so. I feel like that makes a big difference because he's not fighting for everybody.
Right.
And
right. No, Miller was a union guy, was the union leader who revolutionized. I get that.
Yeah. And
I do understand the differences between the two.
Like, if there's a reason why people dislike agents. If there's a Hall of Fame for agents, let's put him there. I don't necessarily think he belongs in the Baseball Hall of Fame.
I think in the grand story of baseball, Scott Boras definitely has a key supporting role. And John, you said that you would do it because of how impactful he's been on the game. But, and again, this kind of what your definition of the Hall of Fame should be is really kind of where you land on this. Because were you impactful on the game, or were you great at the game? Because obviously there's also writers and people who didn't play baseball in the Baseball Hall of Fame. Mm-hmm. But I know that, you know, if you're a small hall person, you want to keep it pretty tight. In this case, you're widening it to be like, well, was this person good for baseball, or did this person impact baseball? And obviously he impacted it, but like you said, it was in good and bad ways. So I don't know if that necessarily makes my criteria, but then again, I'm not sure what my criteria is anymore.
I think my criteria is I want the Baseball Hall of Fame to be a place where you learn about the game of baseball. Mm-hmm. And that means
a bigger one to me.
Yeah, to me, that's a bigger one. Yeah, that's the thing. I think,
and it already is big also.
Right. It's pretty big.
I mean, if they create an agents award, I think that's great. Because Jason Stark is in the Hall of Fame as a Spink Award winner. He was elected by a smaller group, but it isn't the same. Mm-hmm. And so he's in the Hall of Fame in a different way. If they were to come up with some kind of award that an agent could get, depending on the parameters of the award, that's what he should get. But I think that's different. I don't think he is qualified to ever be elected to the Hall of Fame by a veterans committee. I don't believe that they would consider an agent to be someone that they could nominate, actually.
Yeah.
If there was an agent award, wouldn't you have to name it after
you
Scott
would.
Boras, the only agent everyone has ever everyone has heard of?
Right. Especially at least in baseball circles, for sure. No, I get it. You know, and you're right. I think they could come up with an award for that. And you wouldn't have to give it away every year. I mean, I know they do in baseball. They, you know, with the broadcasters and the writers and stuff like that. But it was just it was an interesting thought exercise to me, because I was just kind of thinking along the lines of, you know, let's include the people, let's involve the people who have had huge impacts in the game of baseball. And there's a lot of people in the Baseball Hall of Fame who were good players but also had a negative impact on the game. And that, I'm someone who believes that Pete Rose should probably be in the Hall of Fame, although I'm not actively campaigning for him. But I think, you know, the all-time hits leader and a guy who is it's hard to tell the story of baseball without his name in it. To not have him anywhere in the Hall of Fame is just kind of, it's kind of silly. It's like having a natural history museum and not having anything about dinosaurs in there, you know?
And it's also because of not the worst thing Pete Rose ever did.
That's true, too.
Yeah.
that's true, too.
I'll
so,
say this. If, you know, the Hall of Fame were ever to stop taking itself so freaking seriously, they could put together an entertaining Hall of Shame of people who really screwed up.
Yeah.
You know, not physical violence, not in that way, but guys who really just stepped on their own feet when it comes to baseball, because Pete Rose did not have to do any of that.
No. Nope, not at all. So it's interesting. I mean, I you're right, Justin. The Hall of Fame conversation, generally speaking, is really tiresome. And we don't talk about it much on the podcast.
I'm entertained by this. I find this stuff interesting. I like hearing people's perspectives on, you know,
it should
smaller,
be fun.
Because, when else do we talk about our opinions on the body of baseball as a whole without being, you know, we're angry at it in this way, but usually we're angry at it in a different way. We could be angry at it in this one way during this one time of year.
Well, the Hall of Fame should be a vehicle for us to talk about players from the past. You know, that's really what it should be. And when we're talking about these players and, you know, players who are on the ballot and they're voted on by the baseball writers and stuff like that, I hate the process that they use. It is infuriating and frustrating, but I like it that you have to go through and look at a player's career and, you know, make judgments. Part of what makes sports fun is talking about the players you watched and trying to decide who was better. You know, is this guy worthy of being an all-star? Is it, who's the MVP? You know, all that kind of stuff. And this kind of plays along with that. So, interesting decision by the Veterans Committee. Again, I would have liked to have seen a couple other guys get in there, but you know, two guys, the union head who changed baseball forever and one of the great catchers of all time getting in, I guess not a bad day's work for the Veterans Committee. When we come back, we're going to take a look at the last decade of Phillies baseball, and we're going to do our snake draft for the best Phillies pitchers of the last decade. It's going to be fun at the start, and then it'll get funner as we get a little bit deeper into it. We'll do that next here on Hittin' Season. And we're back on Hittin' Season. All right, so we've been taking a look back at the last decade here on the last couple episodes of Hittin' Season, and we'll try to do that through the end of the year as we finish up the 2010s. Last week, we did our snake draft of the best Phillies hitters of the past decade, and today we are going to go through the best Phillies pitchers of the past decade. And once again, I forgot to draw names, so we're going to do this again.
Oh, come on, man.
Liz in a little bucket here. Do Justin. Talk amongst yourselves while we do this, and then John.
No, we're gonna make everyone listen to you.
Okay, no, we're done. All right. You're kidding me. Liz goes first again. I go second, Justin goes third.
This is exactly what happened. John, if we were just gonna do the same thing, we can
No,
just,
you went second last time and I went third. So,
what? Okay, if this is totally different this time, someone can trade with me if they want. Yeah.
We can trade picks if you want to, Liz.
No, if we don't take it seriously, then why should anyone else? We got to follow the rules.
I just don't want you guys to be upset.
Liz?
Well, go ahead and pick him.
Fire away.
I'm obviously picking Roy Halladay. Mm.
Roy Halladay goes first. Can I give you an interesting bit of statistic on Roy Halladay here?
Sure, always.
Of all the Phillies pitchers of the last decade, he finished fourth in wins above replacement, according to Baseball Reference.
I'm not surprised.
In the past decade, who was ahead of him? Just out of curiosity.
Cole Hamels, Cliff Lee, and Aaron Nola. Although I'm looking at this list, this is an unbelievable number. Roy Halladay, in parts of four seasons, had 18 complete games. Cliff Lee was next closest with 9. I mean, 18 complete games for Roy Halladay.
He was from another time.
It kind of doesn't sound high enough.
It kind of doesn't sound real. Like, he was a real pitcher that pitched for the Phillies, and we watched it.
Yeah.
It happened.
Pretty amazing.
It's still one of the most incredible things. I still don't believe it happened.
I honestly think Roy Halladay and probably the next probably like four guys we're going to pick in this draft really did something as far as, I don't want to make it as simple as expectations, but almost just like culturally, for Phillies fans watching pitchers just because of the tempo of the game and, you know, then the ensuing dominance of those pitchers and like the ease with which it was to just disregard an area of the team as far as an area of need in like this situation when we're about to enter the winter meetings. Like, yeah, you know, maybe the Phillies want to get some bullpen pieces, but as far as like the rotation goes, you don't really have to think about it.
Yeah.
And it was the case, you know, with a couple of different guys, but like that was pretty close to the case for, the better part of 5 years. And that's an eternity in baseball. When you look at the rest of this decade that we're going to look at and how there are just no names that we're going to call
point.
From at least 5 or 6 years, maybe more. Like,
yeah, no kidding. Well, maybe what we can do is we can do a bench player snake draft for next week, and we can dig up some good names. That'll be a good time. We'll
gotta
do that
find
next
me
week.
See if Ross Clode actually played in this decade.
Oh,
I want a little bit of Ross Clode. I'm a fan.
Did he ever? All right, I'm up next. I'm going to go with Cliff Lee with the number two pick there. Cliff Lee was just freaking amazing, and he had the postseason success, which you really like, and a 3.8% walk rate for the decade of the 2010s. That's insanity. It's insanity. So I'm going with Cliff Lee, number two. Justin, you get two picks here. We're going four rounds, by the way, for those who didn't catch the last episode, so we'll pick 12 players total.
All right. Well, this is great, actually, because then I get two of these guys. Obviously, first, I'll go with Cole Hamels. Mm-hmm. And in doing a little research on Cole for a separate podcast that rhymes with the Schmerdy Schminning.
I think I know
what it could be.
There's a lot more to Cole Hamels' stories than I think we really remember and how much he actually, like, health-wise, had to overcome on his way to the majors. Just reading about his, like, getting drafted out of high school and the negotiations going on for so long because there were five other pitchers in high school drafted above him, and they had to wait for the market to get settled. Like, Scott Kazmir was drafted above him, and they had to wait for guys like him to, like, get their deals, and people were, like, really antsy because this was the Phillies' number one pick at 17, and he was supposed to be this incredible pitcher with this high 90s fastball and an awesome changeup, and we were really scorned because a lot of what people knew about draft picks and the Phillies picking good ones was like JD Drew, and he, you know, that is not a good story for Phillies and draft picks. So, like, that went on forever. He was overcoming a broken arm coming out of high school, and for a while they thought his career was, like, not gonna happen until he made a start when he was a senior in high school, and a bunch of scouts showed up just like, oh, Cole Hamels is going to try to pitch again. Let's see what this is like. And in his first inning, he struck out the side on 9 pitches. So, seeing that talent kind of hit the major leagues and the success that he had as everything we all know he was, I think only like a 4-time All-Star, but a World Series MVP, an NLCS MVP, and being like one of the key parts of the first sports championship in Philadelphia in 25 years. I mean, I don't know if you can say enough about Cole Hamels and what he did for baseball in Philadelphia. So he is definitely my pick. And then I'll just round out our selection of aces by just picking Roy Oswalt with my second pick.
That's not where I thought you were going to go.
Yeah, I know. I feel like there's a more modern selection.
Yeah,
there.
And I'm going to take him. I thought that's who you were going
too.
With.
But I was feeling a little dusty, and I know Roy wasn't here that long, but he played, and he kind of was in, I think, of this like ace filled rotation. He slunk in the background, especially since that rotation where they were all together. He actually got hurt that year, I believe, and didn't pitch in as many. Did he?
No, he did. Yeah. I think he was healthy, wasn't he? In 2011, you're talking about, or 2010?
Yeah. Maybe, well, he was halfway through 2010. They got him from the Astros.
Right.
I felt like, for some reason, I felt like he got hurt in
2011.
But no, he made 23 starts.
Oh, you're right.
Starts.
139 innings. You're right. He didn't pitch. He missed some games that season. You're right.
But I know he was an instant gif. And,
was that? Hang on a second. Was that the year that he like helped out with like disaster relief or something like that? Or do you remember?
Yeah, there
like,
was one where his family home was either hit or in the area where I think a tornado made landfall. And he went back to like help clear wreckage, I believe, at some point as well. Oswalt was kind of a background guy, a supporting character in that cast, and he wasn't here nearly as long as some of the other guys, but his acquisition was a huge part of the 2010 season when he came along. It was just another affirmation or confirmation that the Phillies were all in and that they were a team that just brought in the biggest talent at the trade deadline because they were always in the playoff hunt, and he put up great numbers for the Phillies. In 2010, he came over. He had that rough start in his first start with the Phillies, but he threw 82 innings for them and had a 1.74 ERA. I mean, that's you can't ask for much more from a starting pitcher going down the stretch. And then in 2011, he had not as great a year, but if Roy Oswalt is your fourth best pitcher, I think you're doing okay. So I went with Roy I also have appreciation for Aaron Nola, but I had to go with Roy for the nostalgia.
I'm looking at the 2011 season for Roy Oswalt here. He took a leave of absence on April 27th to check on his family after his home was devastated with a tornado in Mississippi. But then he later spent several weeks on the DL with a back injury later in the season. So, and probably the most disappointing moment I had with Roy Oswalt, and I don't remember him as fondly. I know he was pretty good while he was here, but that game four against the Cardinals in the NLDS, the Phillies are up 2-1, the Rally Squirrel game, when he gave up 5 runs in 6 innings that day was just...
Yeah. But you just picked Cliff Lee, and I remember a certain 2011 playoff game.
But he also kicked ass in the 2009 World Series, too.
That's not in this decade, sir.
Ooh.
Sir.
Nice.
Shut up
nice.
With your facts, Liz
Listen,
Rocher.
If we're doing this
also,
for real.
I know. Also, you're Roy right, Oswalt, right. When Aaron Nola, who again I love, and I'm just saying, when Aaron Nola runs through a stop sign in the playoffs wearing a windbreaker and scores a crucial run, I will pick Aaron Nola.
Yeah, I forgot about that.
Did you guys realize that the Phillies declined his option after 2011? They could have had him for 2012,
man.
His option.
That's
but apparently
road not taken a little bit.
Yeah, well, he didn't pitch all that well in 2012. No. He signed a minor league deal with the Rangers.
Well, who knows how he could have done if he'd stayed in Philly.
Well, they moved him to the bullpen on July 31st. Bumped out of the rotation after the Rangers acquired Ryan Dempster.
Oh, that's a name from the past.
Yeah, so Roy Oswalt's
I feel like
career
he's still pitching for the White Sox.
Kind of went south in a hurry there. I'm going to make this quick. I'm taking Aaron Nola number 2. I had Oswalt ready to go. So I'm very happy to see Aaron Nola drop down to number 5 in this.
This one's going to get a lot more interesting.
Like Rev's going to say, like right at this moment, it's getting interesting.
Yeah,
like,
I was going to say, who is this going to go with here?
We have, like, if you think that there might've been a drop off, you know, from that group, this is a chasm.
Wow. I'm looking at the names I wrote down. The last 4 don't even make sense. Like, why did I write them down?
It's like Wile E. Coyote
all
falling
right.
off the
so
cliff
this is,
here.
This is what I'm facing. I'm gonna talk about it a little bit. So,
all right.
I hope you don't pick my guy. Oh, my
So there are 2 names jumping out at me as being worth taking, because if you look in the last few years beyond Aaron Nola, there's no one there. Who am I picking from there? I'm not picking Zach Eflin. Or Nick Pivetta, or Vince Velasquez. You look in those first couple of years at those peripheral guys, and it's essentially Kyle Kendrick and Vance Worley. Am I missing someone?
Jamie Moyer.
Jay Happ was here for a minute and a half in 2010.
What about Joe Blanton?
He was around.
Joe
he did
was
real
here
bad.
Through 2012.
I looked at him.
4.75 ERA in the decade.
Yeah, Vance Worley was here for 3 seasons. Made 46 starts, 277 innings pitched. He has a 3.50 ERA. I think he's literally the next best option. I'm going to pick Vance Worley.
Vance Worley.
Yeah, suck it. Suck it.
Justin's upset.
I love Vance Worley.
He was
awesome.
Awesome.
For him to come up, wreck specs, led the, I might be talking out of my butt here, but I feel like there was a point where he led all of baseball and called 30 strikes.
Yes, he did. Yep.
Okay. He had a complete game.
He had that fastball that looked like it was coming right out of guy's hip and just dipped over the inside part of the plate.
He pitched in the postseason. Yep. That's you probably forget that. He didn't do well. But he did pitch in the postseason. And he was a young arm who the Phillies didn't deserve at a time when they had a bounty of quality starting pitching in their rotation, and they called him up, and I don't think anybody was really expecting a whole lot from him.
No,
he wasn't one of the Phillies' top prospects, was hotly anticipated or anything, and he came up and he did really well for that team. I don't think he didn't have a extremely good career following his time with the Phillies or even during his time with the Phillies, but he played in the majors for 8 years. I mean, that's a ton.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And he finished 3rd in Rookie of the Year voting in 2011.
Remember that?
Freddie Freeman and Craig Kimbrell were the only ones ahead of him.
That's right, because he filled in for Oswalt while Oswalt didn't.
What a time
while Oswalt
to
was
be alive,
recovering.
That
that's
was.
Right. Oh my gosh.
I mean, he didn't get any first place votes, but he had more WAR than Freddie Freeman that year by a lot. He had 3.5. Freddie was worth 1.5 wins.
Wow.
That's crazy.
He had more than Kimbrel, too. Good Lord. He had the most of anybody they voted for that year.
He had everyone fooled for like a good 18 months.
Yep.
Man. And then they also, side note, did you know Freddie Freeman, Vance Worley, and Kenley Jansen were all rookies the same year? I thought Kenley Jansen was.
Are you
50.
Kidding? Yeah.
Wow.
Wow.
That's phenomenal.
All right,
I
got one more pick.
Vance Worley. You got one more.
I would soon.
Wait. Why are you
it's
going?
It's a snake draft.
Oh,
it's
right.
It's a snake draft.
Okay.
I would rather shoot my own foot off than pick Kyle Kendrick for my team.
He's not
I'm
on my
picking,
list at all.
I'm going to make one of you pick him. I'm picking Joe Blanton. I'm going to say, I don't care.
Blanton.
He had an interesting 2010 at moments. I don't care who else was left in that 2018, 2017, 2016 group. I'm picking Joe Blanton.
You know, it's funny. I mean, we're looking at Kyle Kendrick, and I think he's probably going to get picked at some point.
Not by me.
Second most starts of any Phillies pitcher this decade.
He sucks.
Second most. Only Cole Hamels started more games for the
That's
Phillies
disgusting.
In the 2010s than Kyle Kendrick.
It's amazing.
Think about that,
no.
people.
Borderline inexcusable.
It really is.
He was so bad for so
my
much
third
of it.
For my third pick, I'm going to go with Jared Eichhoff. It's not a sexy pick, but I'm like you, Liz. I can't go Velasquez or Pivetta, and for about a season and a half there, Jared Eichhoff was really, really, really good. It's a shame he got injured, because he was in 2015 when we came over, and then 2016, he was really, really good. You know, there's not a lot of other better options here at this point, so that's the best of a bunch of bad options for me with this pick here in the third round. So I'll take Eichhoff here. Seventh most starts of any Phillies pitcher in the last decade. All right, Justin, your last two.
Well, so looking at what's available. Not anything I'm really proud of. I'm about to make some choices I'm not proud of.
I can't wait to see this. I'm so excited.
I am parsing game logs, trying to find a patch of success that'll work as a defense for any of these picks.
Oh, I'm so excited.
I was going to lean towards Jamie Moyer just for legacy's sake, but I kind of did that with Oswalt, and it cost me dearly with Nola going in the next pick, and then losing Vance Worley, who I for some reason thought I could sneak past you guys, but there was
like
just no way that was going to happen,
nope.
Given how starved we are here. So, you know, Tyler Cloyd
no!
made a couple of good starts.
No, you're not doing Tyler Cloyd. I won't allow it.
I'm not picking Kyle Kendrick. And Tyler Cloyd had two straight starts May 2013
yep.
where he
mm-hmm.
struck out a combined 9 hitters.
That's, wow.
That's information. That's some information we can share.
Am I writing down Tyler Cloyd?
Yeah, absolutely. You can give me Tyler Cloyd.
Oh,
yeah.
My gosh.
Why not?
Wow.
He kept his ERA under 5 for 2 starts, sir. And then he got blown up by the Red Sox.
And mockery is being
didn't want to
made
pick
of
John
this
Lannon,
exercise.
Did
I'll
you?
Say that.
Oh, hell no. Not John Lannon. John Lannon's biggest value is that he was not facing Phillies hitters anymore.
That he wasn't hitting Chase Utley. He's the guy that hit Utley, right?
Yes,
it is.
My next pick is better.
Oh, man.
I'm really excited.
Can we separate pitchers into parts of seasons, or do we have to accept all of the shame that
it's
comes?
It's all the shame.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
You can't put an asterisk on this made-up game.
You know, and I think we can all agree the worst year, I think, of the past couple years – records wise was 2015. I think that was rock bottom,
yep,
the rock bottom
bad.
Year. So there wasn't a whole lot to seek joy in around that time. But you know, the Phillies were in the market for a lot of pitchers they could acquire with no intention of really having them around for very long, and hoping that they could acquire them and then watch them pitch well and then trade them to other places. And one of the guys they acquired for this purpose was Aaron Harang, who put together this actually makes sense, not like Tyler Cloyd. going into the All-Star game in 2015, He had a 2.02 ERA, 53 strikeouts, 15 walks, and 190 ERA plus in just over 71 innings pitched. The Phillies didn't have a lot of great players. By May 31st, I'm reading this. This is a tweet from Beyond the Box Score. They told us Max Scherzer was leading National League pitchers with 3 FWAR. Next closest, Aaron Harang at 1.8. We also learned Aaron Harang had the lowest home ERA in the majors by the end of May, and the 8th lowest ERA in all of baseball in general. His ERA at home during that stretch was 0.61. I mean, that's 2 months. That's not nothing. It's not nothing. Don't
we
tell
were
me
all
it's
excited
nothing.
Exactly there for a while.
Either, though.
By the time it was the All-Star break, his ERA was over 4.
So
and,
quick.
He was not the Phillies All-Star. I don't think.
He wasn't the answer.
We'd remember that.
I wrote something about him, you know, being their All-Star.
I remember you writing that too.
Pickings were slim. They were. They just were. As I'm mining these, I looked at Eflin. I kind of glanced at Charlie Morton's very brief Phillies
career. Don't you say Charlie Morton's name.
You took Vance Worley from me, and now I'm done picking. Screw you guys. And then Jamie Moyer. And that was kind of the only names I had down. I had Eichhoff on my list, too, but I wasn't really sure why. But then again, he pitched better than, like, Joe Blanton.
He did. Yeah, there was a stretch there where Aaron Harang, it looked like, hey, maybe they're going to actually get something out of this guy. And
so, yeah, I'm going to go with Tyler Cloyd and Aaron Harang, and then I'm going to get off this podcast and live with myself.
Somebody's got to. I'm going to go. I literally thought about Kyle Kendrick here. I really did think about Kyle Kendrick. I just can't bring myself to do it. You know, if I'm looking at this in a way, if I really wanted to win baseball games, I probably would do something like Velasquez or Jeremy Hellickson.
If
Jeremy
I wanted Hellickson to win games.
This is what we're talking about here. Jeremy Hellickson had a .545 winning percentage with the Phillies, just so you'll know. But I'm going to go with Charlie Morton. That's what I wanted to. You said his name. I thought, oh man, I'll sneak Charlie Morton by everybody. Nobody will ever suspect
screw you,
it.
Pal.
I know Charlie Morton. What, 5 starts? Isn't that what it was? I think he had 5 starts with the Phillies. I'm scrolling down to see if I can figure out exactly. But you could tell he was back. You could tell that he had discovered something. It was all the talk in spring training. He discovered 3 extra miles an hour on his fastball. And if he doesn't blow out his hamstring in the middle of that season, what was it, 2016, I think it was, then, you know, they probably sign him to a long-term deal. He's in the rotation for a long time. 4 starts for Charlie Morton that season, and that was it. And so what could have been Charlie Morton in another alternate universe in the multiverse, Charlie Morton is a 3-time All-Star with the Phillies and helped them win a World Series in 2019. But here we are. All right, Liz, your final pick of this scintillating snake draft of Phillies pitchers from the last decade.
I'll throw out a couple of names that I thought about and discarded. Jonathan Pettibone. He had a decent season, 4.04 ERA, serviceable. Then it rocketed to, I think, somewhere in the 6th range.
A baby ace. Make it to the majors.
9.00 ERA for Jonathan Pettibone in his second season. I thought about David Buchanan, who is over in Japan, having success as a pitcher in Japan. But he had a great season for the Phillies. And then in his second season, had a 6.99 ERA.
Man, Buchanan was a great choice.
Yes, but I could not accept that. So I picked the only man with 2 names. The man who until 2011 was known as Fausto Carmona. I picked Roberto Hernandez, who pitched.
I thought you were going to say Jerome.
No,
Williams.
He sucked for the Phillies overall. 23 games, 20 starts, 121 innings until he was traded, I think, to the Dodgers. 3.87 ERA. That is literally the best you could do.
I think we kind of blew it not picking David Buchanan.
No,
honestly.
Should
we go a 5th round?
Are you high?
So we can include David Buchanan.
No,
right.
You think
we blew it not picking? I'm sorry. I'm not saying Liz. I'm not saying you should have. I'm saying we should have. Yeah. He was probably a better option than
really
some
for
of
his
us,
5.01 ERA.
What do you want me to say? These are terrible
pitchers. Yeah, but at least at least Fausto Carmona was good enough to be traded somewhere.
I realize we went for comedy here for these later rounds.
We have to.
It is hysterical that we're so emotionally numb to Vince Velasquez and Nick Pivetta and Jake Arrieta that even though they are clearly better pitchers than some of these cats, we just couldn't.
I wrote down Jake Arrieta, but then I looked it up and was like,
Well, let's just put it this way. Jake Arrieta over Tyler Cloyd most of the time would probably be.
Not for two starts in May. I don't know. I looked at the numbers, and if I'm going to analytics this, I'm going to, Cloyd's my guy.
Well, you are a Fangraphs reporter, so I mean,
I'm going to take some heat for this, but trust me, the cutest move is always the right one. Send in the Cloyd, I always say.
Send in the Cloyd.
Good night. Oh my gosh. The Cloyd Wars. All right. On that note, we need to finish things up here now because this is getting into the ludicrous. Justin, any final thoughts before we wrap up?
Oh, yeah. I'm looking at Jake Arrieta's numbers. And what I just said should get me disbarred if there was a bar for writing and talking about baseball. vastly superior options.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah, is it nice to be able to look back on these years and not be currently living them from exclusively a baseball standpoint, not a living our lives standpoint?
I think it is.
To be finished and through with it, yeah.
Do you think we are done at the moment logging these types of years? I mean, the last two have been disappointing, but in a different way, I would suggest.
For a little while. I mean, I don't know. It depends. If the Phillies don't do much more to the pitching staff, you could have another season where 20 different Phillies pitchers make starts this year. Mm-hmm. So those are always the years when you get the really fun names when you look back 10 years into the future, or 10 years into the past. When you get seasons when you have to try and fill a bunch of guys from AAA into the starting rotation. Like, oh my gosh, that's right. He was a starting pitcher.
And also, just as a quick self-promotion bit, John, you mentioned Fangraphs, where I am a writer, and last week I got to write about the Wichita Wind Surge, a AAA franchise for the Marlins that just moved into Wichita, going to have its first season, and they had a bit of a public debate about the choice of the name Wind Surge. If you're sitting here asking yourself what that is, you can learn what that is in the article and what the townspeople of Wichita felt like they deserved to have their team name and their town represented by a more accurate name. And also the just sort of the process that went into determining that name, because the VP of the team and the assistant GM, they kind of went about it in a little bit of a different way than teams typically do in that position. And it also just gives you an idea of how much minor league baseball matters in these smaller U.S. towns where they don't have access to big league baseball and they might lose it. And as we know, as a list is circulating with a possible death sentence for 42 or at least restructuring for 42 minor league baseball teams. So it was an interesting story. It was really fun to write. So if you're into that kind of thing, I would suggest you check it out.
All right. Sounds good. Check out Fangraphs. Check out Justin's piece there. Liz, any final thoughts from you?
I was looking at Cliff Lee's numbers because I remembered a particular month of his career that I don't know if any Phillies pitcher has ever matched. His June 2011, he had a 0.21 ERA over 42 innings, 29 strikeouts, 3 complete games out of 5 starts. He went 7
Pretty
innings,
good.
8 innings, 9, 9, and 9.
Jeez.
I feel like also if we'd really wanted to make this an exercise in cuteness and not accuracy, none of us even brought up Wilson Valdez.
True. And on that note, friends, we wrap up.
Or Jeff Francoeur.
Jeff Francoeur would have been the one to go after there. All right. Well, that'll do it for episode 342 of Hittin' Season. My thanks to Justin and Liz for being co-hosts on the podcast once again here on Sunday night. Folks, just a reminder, if you haven't yet, check out our Patreon. We got lots of good stuff up on the Patreon right now. And tell a friend about the Patreon. We got good written content. We've got some bonus podcasts that Justin did with Chris Jones that are fantastic. And we're going to have some more stuff going up there here over the next couple of weeks and months. So make sure you go to patreon.com/hittin'season and sign up on the $5 $5 a month tier. And as far as the main Good Fight podcast feed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcast, tell your friends about that as well. Have them subscribe, download, rate, and review. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. We'll talk to you next time here on Hittin' Season.